From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama. Four Ku Klux Klansmen bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church on that Sunday, September 15th, 1963. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would call it, quote, one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetrated against humanity. The explosion at the church killed four young girls that day, Addie Mae Collins, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, and Carol Denise McNair. A 15-year-old girl named Fania Davis was close friends with two of the victims, and she was devastated. Davis became an activist at a young age, calling for justice on many levels of society. She became a civil rights lawyer. She's devoted her professional career to fighting racial discrimination. And today, Fania Davis focuses on what is called restorative justice, which seeks a different path toward justice and building relationships. In many ways, it is the opposite of a strict zero-tolerance policy on discipline. Now, next week, Fania Davis is coming to Rochester as a guest of the Rochester City School District. But first, we had the chance to talk with her. In a moment, you're going to hear Connections producer Megan Mack and her conversation with Fania Davis. Let me also welcome our guests for the hour who are with me live in studio. Kit Miller is here from the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. Kit, welcome back to the program. Nice to see you here on Connections.
Thank you, Evan.
And Ruth Turner is here, a school social worker. Ruth, nice to see you as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Do I have something wrong here? Is everything okay?
Ruth is in charge of all the...
Oh, I'm sorry. See, look, I've got... We're gonna get everything squared away here. What I want to let you know is you're about to hear from Fania Davis. Fania coming to Rochester. And again, let our guests in studio know. When's Fania coming? Is it next week?
Yes, she'll be here next Wednesday for two free talks. One at lunchtime at REOC downtown on Chestnut Street, and the second one at RIT at 5:30.
Okay, so we'll get into the details on what you can expect with that coming up. But first, this is producer Megan Mack and her conversation with Fania Davis.
People hear the phrases restorative justice and school-to-prison pipeline, but they may be unsure about what they mean. Can you define them and talk about how restorative practices may dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline?
Let me start first with a discussion about what restorative justice is. You could say that our current justice system, our criminal justice system in particular, asks three questions. What law was broken or what rule was broken in the school context, who broke it, and what punishment is deserved. So you could say that our current system is focused on blame and punishment. Who violated the law and what punishment is deserved? You could say that our system responds to the original harm with an additional harm. If I hurt somebody, then that creates an imbalance in the scales of justice, and the only way to rebalance the scales is for some harm to be done to me. So you could say that ours is a system that harms people who harm people to show that harming people is wrong. And, of course, that just replicates harm. Restorative justice seeks to flip the script. It asks different questions. One, who was harmed? And what are the needs and responsibilities of those impacted by the harm? And how do all impacted come together and heal the harm as much as possible? So it's concerned about responding to harm with healing, with, if you will, creating a sort of endless cycle of healing rather than a vicious cycle of harming. So in schools, what this looks like is that instead of just being concerned about what rule was violated and who did it and what punishment is deserved, you know, how long will they be suspended or will they be expelled or will they be arrested, restorative justice seeks to heal whatever harm has been caused. And let me give an example of that. Say Tommy has his head on the desk, and the teacher is distracted. The history teacher is distracted by his not paying attention, his apparently sleeping through her class. So she asks him kindly, politely, to sit up straight. And he doesn't respond. And she's a little more agitated. She asks him again, sit up straight, Tommy. He still doesn't respond. So by the third time, she's virtually yelling at the top of her lungs, demanding that he sit up straight. And at this point, he jumps up and in a very aggressive bodily posture, confronts her and yells at her. And there's a big altercation that ensues. It goes out into the hallway. The principal comes. The school security officer comes. The restorative justice coordinator comes. The school principal is ready to suspend him, because that's what you do when you violate a rule against cursing out teachers, being respectful to teachers. The punishment is to be suspended for 4 days or 5 days. So the principal is ready to do that. But the restorative justice coordinator says, can I try something else? In the meantime, Tommy is flailing and angry and cursing and not at all, listening or reasoning, until the restorative justice coordinator asks, are you okay, Tommy? Are you all right? And that's when Tommy calms down. So what happens is that the restorative justice coordinator takes him to the restorative justice room and gets Tommy's backstory. Tommy has been at home by himself for the last 3 days. His mother has relapsed. He's been taking care of his little brother and sister, getting them off to school, feeding them. And he's been making it to school himself, but he's got his head on the desk that morning because he's scared, he's tired, he's anxious. And, of course, restorative justice seeks to get that backstory. And rather than suspending him, they do a circle. The teacher gets to hear his story. He gets to hear the teacher's story. The teacher has had a bad experience a year before where someone actually assaulted her. And it started with yelling. And so she was re-traumatized and was about to quit. So they get to share these stories. The mother has been found. The restorative justice coordinator tracks down the mother. She's in the circle. She takes responsibility for having caused the problems that they're dealing with. So Tommy apologizes to the teacher. The teacher apologizes to Tommy. Tommy's needs are addressed, and the teacher's needs are addressed. Tommy agrees to help the teacher with chores over the next couple of weeks, and the teacher agrees that when she sees a student engaging in this kind of behavior that she might think is disrespectful, she'll instead try to have a discreet conversation. So this response actually has an impact on the school-to-prison pipeline. Studies show that when students are suspended and on the streets without adult supervision, if they're suspended once by the ninth grade, their chance of being incarcerated triples, and their chance of dropping out doubles. And we know that across the country, inmates in state prisons are 75% high school dropouts. So keeping a child in school is a strong protective factor against incarceration. So that's how we're working in Oakland. We're creating alternatives to out-of-school suspension, which are having the effect, among other many other positive effects, of interrupting the school-to-prison pipeline.
You mentioned in a talk that you did in November of last year about seeing a student. So walking into a school, seeing the student as a person, but knowing who that student is behind the physical human being. So they have a backstory. They have issues that they're bringing into the school. How does restorative justice adjust to that?
In that talk that you referenced, I probably mentioned the word sawubona, which is an African greeting, a South African greeting. Sawubona, this is how traditionally Zulus greeted one another in the marketplace or on a dusty road. And sawubona, which is the same as our hello, or how you doing, you know, what's happening, what's up, is I see you. And it means I see you, not just the externals. You know, I see beyond your hoodie. I see beyond your sagging pants. You know, I see beyond the color of your skin. I see who you truly are. I see the gift that you are to the world. And that is, in many respects, just sort of the essence of this work that we do in restorative justice. That restorative justice coordinator and ultimately the teacher began to see Tommy for who he was. The principal even said, after he found out Tommy's backstory, he said, we were about to kick that kid to the curb when what he deserved was a medal. You know, he is getting his younger siblings out to school. He's only 14 years old. Just seeing the gifts that our children are, rather than seeing them as thugs, as gangsters, in stereotyped ways, is a huge part of the work that we do. And we find that when our children are seen, when they feel seen, and when they feel heard, that they thrive. And that's what this work is all about. We create spaces in circles and in one-on-one conversations for our youth's voices to be heard and for them to be seen. And we basically keep on seeing the gifts that they are until they begin to see themselves. And we've been able to completely eliminate violence at, for example, one of our pilot schools in Oakland, Ralph Bunch, which is a continuation school for juvenile justice-involved youth. At that school, after 2 years, we were able to completely eliminate fighting when that school had been a school with a heavy police presence and with lots of fights going on. And the graduation rates increased at that school, test scores increased, and our district-wide studies of restorative justice schools compared to non-restorative justice schools are showing a similar decreases in violence, decreases in racial disparity, and increases in graduation rates and decreases in dropout rates and increases in test scores. A major study was done about a year ago documenting some really stunning academic gains. And we're finding that our youth are using these restorative processes in their homes and in their neighborhoods as well.
We hear from a lot of our listeners who are concerned about the success of students in the Rochester City School District. Many of them live in the city, but we also hear from many in the suburbs and surrounding areas. And some think that a restorative justice approach may be too light or maybe too soft. What would you say to those who believe that students need structure and firm discipline?
Well, I think they do need structure. And I think we do need to be firm. We need to give them a lot of structure. We need to be firm with them. But that's not the same as being punitive and having a response that basically hurts them because they've hurt someone else. We know that this kind of punishment for the sake of punishment, I shouldn't say punishment for the sake of punishment, but we know that punishment simply doesn't work. We know that because we see that, at least in Oakland, if our youth are caught committing a crime, they are blamed for it, they're punished for it. And they do their punishment, whether it's a year and a half, and they come out, and they're 75 to 90% likely to do something again, to reoffend. Those are the recidivism rates in the state of California for our youth. For our local facilities, or for incarceration in local detention facilities or in state, 75% or 90%. So that, to me, is not being hard on crime. Yeah, you may hurt a child who's hurt somebody else, but they go out and they commit more crime. So that is causing more crime, you know, to punish, because we know that harm people go on to harm other people. So if you, just like with Tommy, you know, Tommy had been harmed because his mother, you know, was had relapsed and was out for 3 nights. And he went on to harm this teacher because she was yelling at him. So, you know, as Dr. King says, violence will never drive out violence only, or actually he says, hate will never drive out hatred, only love will. And as Mahatma Gandhi says, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth only makes the world blind and toothless. And darkness cannot be driven out by more darkness. It can only be driven out by light. So so that's one thing. And the other thing is, it's not easy to sit in a restorative justice circle and face the person that you have hurt. And our youth sometimes say, no, I don't want to do that. You know, it's harder to apologize. It's harder to listen, you know. And it's some ways easier just to go and serve your time and not have to worry about what you did, not have to even think about the person that you hurt, not to have to face the person. It takes, you know, we say all the time, and our youth say all the time, yeah, this is what being a man is. It's facing up, you know, to what you've done and apologizing and making amends, you know. It's much harder.
Let's go back into the classroom with Tommy and create another hypothetical situation. So maybe Tommy continues to be disruptive. Maybe he starts throwing pens or being unruly. He's very distracting to the other students. And the teacher reaches a point where she feels that the only option is to remove him from the classroom or enforce some kind of firm disciplinary action. What would you say to that teacher? What would your advice be before removing him from the classroom?
Times our teachers, before it even gets to that, will go out and will take, you know, discreetly, she'll go up to Tommy. Tommy, let's talk. Are you okay? We find that just saying something like, are you okay, kind of takes the child out of that fight or flight trauma response. Now, if you come at them in a punitive way, come at them yelling, then they are going to perceive you as another threat in their environment, and that's going to reinforce a fight response. It won't get them into their front brain where they can access executive functioning and reason and learn. So our teachers are trained to have restorative conversations, and very often these conversations will happen out in the hallway. Or if not, you know, the restorative justice coordinator comes and gets the child. But yeah, I mean, if the child is in a full, you know, fight or flight kind of trauma response in the classroom, then the child needs to be removed temporarily. We need to ask, well, what's going on with you? You know, what's happening, and what are your needs, and engage in a needs-based response. I mean, I'm reminded of this girl in the Spring Valley situation in the Carolinas. I don't know if you saw that video of the girl who had her phone, and it was a violation of school rule. The teacher asked the child to put the phone away, a little black girl. And she didn't put the phone away. So the teacher called the school security officer, and she still didn't put the phone away. And the school security officer basically, you know, pulled her out of the chair and while she was still in the chair, threw her across the classroom. But that was an example of how it doesn't work to do things to our children. And we in restorative justice, we don't do things to, we don't punish in that way, because a child is breaking a rule. We do things with them. You know, what's going on with you? So there are times clearly when behaviors make it impossible for a child to stay in the classroom, but it doesn't mean that we take them out of the classroom and suspend them where they will be without adult supervision and where they will lose instructional time. And especially for youth of color, this will definitely put them at risk for incarceration, three times greater risk for incarceration when they are put out of school altogether, even for a few days.
I'd like to briefly ask for your thoughts about military academies. Just yesterday, an advisory committee in Rochester revealed the results of a public survey about bringing a military academy to the Rochester City School District. The committee says that most residents approved of the idea. It would be one school And city leaders say it would just be one of the many tools the district needs to improve graduation rates and retention rates and academic performance. What are your thoughts on a military academy?
I would be more interested in a peace academy because that's what we need in our world. That's what we need in our communities. We need peacemakers or warriors for peace. If by military academy we're talking about a school that has zero tolerance policies and that engages, when I say zero tolerance, I mean that they are punished for any rule violation, including expulsion, or if military academy means using suspension for even, I'm thinking of children who are adolescents and have milk fights in the cafeteria. A zero-tolerance school would actually arrest these kids for assault, and this has actually happened. We have youth who, as adolescents, because they were throwing milk cartons at one another in the cafeteria, were arrested for assault. And this is the result of a zero-tolerance policy that criminalizes normal adolescent behaviors. So if we're talking about a school or a military academy that uses those kinds of policies, or say we've seen situations where a six-year-old with a temper tantrum is escorted out of the classroom in handcuffs on charges of assault, or a child who writes on a desk, you know, with even with erasable ink, is arrested for defacing public property. These are all real things that have happened in zero-tolerance schools. In schools that are criminalizing our students instead of educating and nurturing them. So if a military academy adheres to these zero-tolerance policies, I would not advocate for that. I would prefer to see peace schools that that view discipline not as hurting someone, but discipline as teaching. Let's make this a teachable moment for you, rather than, you know, you're out of here, or you're going to be arrested for this, or you're going to be expelled or suspended for this. It's the way that I would treat my child. That's the way that I raise my child. When wrongdoing occurs, you know, sitting down and talking about, well, what happened and what do you think the impact was of what you did? And if you hurt somebody, what are you going to do to make it right? You know, how are you going to make amends for this and face the person that you've hurt, you know?
Your visit to Rochester is next week. What is your goal when meeting with city school leaders and other local groups?
Really, I am more interested in what their goal is. If they are interested in how they might implement restorative justice in the schools, or if they've already implemented it, deepening the process, then I am there to be of service to them. Whatever is needed, I hope that I can address those needs with my visit.
That's producer Megan Mack interviewing Fania Davis, who is coming next week. We're going to get a short break, and we're coming back spending the hour live here in studio with a conversation about restorative justice, about discipline, about helping kids who've dealt with trauma, and more. Let's have that conversation after this short break right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on the next Connections. You might have seen the story in the New York Times about big Democratic money going to the campaign of then-Senator Ted O'Brien. It's a follow-the-money story, and it looks like some laws might have been broken. We're going to be taking a look at that in our first hour. Then in our second hour, previewing the Rochester Cocktail Revival, how Rochester is trying to get on the national map of cocktail cities. Talk to you Thursday.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Shepherd Ford, serving upstate New York for more than 60 years, offering new and pre-owned cars, trucks, and SUVs, including hybrids. Located on Routes 5 and 20 in Canandaigua and online at shepherdbrosford.com.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined now in studio by Ruth Turner, who is the Executive Director of Student Support Services for the Rochester City School District. Ruth, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Kit Miller is here from the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. She's the director. Kit, thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure.
Well, I don't know who's responsible for bringing Fania. If it's Kit or Ruth, you're both pointing at each other here. I want to start with Ruth on why you wanted to bring someone like that with that background, with her expertise, and with her focus on this issue, at a time where there are community conversations about trauma, discipline, helping kids in various ways. First of all, why did you want to bring her, Ruth?
Well, actually, I had the pleasure of attending a training with her a couple of years back and was just absolutely fascinated by her style of presentation and just her experiences in Oakland and other school districts that are very similar to our school district, and felt like in those couple of days I learned so much from her. And Kit and I do a lot of work together, and one day we were sort of discussing our sheroes, if you would say, and that came up, and Kit was familiar with her and just really had this vision of moving our whole community, not just our district, to be a more restorative, therapeutic, inviting community, and envisioning that, you know, how can we make that happen? And the one thing that kept coming up was this commonality for appreciation for the work that Dr. Davis has done. So together we said we have to try to make this work. And it's actually been, we've had our ups and downs, and we're just so glad that we finally have her and she's coming to Rochester. And we feel like this is just a beginning, hopefully, of a movement that will continue.
Can the public meet her?
Yes.
Tell me about the events coming up.
Okay, so on Wednesday, May 4th, she will be speaking at REOC starting at 12:30. She'll do a talk, and this is open to the community, free of charge. And it's really the idea that Kit and I, when we sat down, talked and envisioned for our community is the radical work of community healing. How can we as a community begin to heal from the trauma, from the poverty, you know, from all the ills that we experience every day, whether it's racism, sexism, and how does restorative practice play a role in that transformation that we're hoping to engage in our community? So yes, the public can come. There'll be light refreshments, and she will speak, and they will have an opportunity to ask questions and to meet her.
She's coming in to talk restorative practices, but I think it's important to point out, and Ruth can speak at length on this, this is in some ways already happening here. We had a listener named Dwayne email the program, and Dwayne says, isn't East High doing something like this already? And Ruth said during the break, yeah, but they're not alone. So
absolutely.
How many schools are adopting this kind of a discipline model?
So yes, East High is adopted this model and have been working really hard in training their staff and students on ways to engage with each other that are more restorative. Also, the larger city school district for maybe the last 2 years we've been planning on ways on how to bring this to life. So one thing that we did the starting of this school year, which was September 2015, is we piloted 15 schools that have accepted the invitation to take this journey on doing things, business a bit different in a way that is more restorative, less punitive. And also incorporate the whole idea of healing. You know, our students are traumatized. In some levels, our community experiences a great deal of trauma. And it's like, instead of punishment per se, but how do we begin to heal these experiences that we're having? So we have 15 schools this year that have taken this journey with us. They're engaged in the learning, the implementation. One is Northeast Northwest, who their principal actually was previously in Avon and has been a practitioner of restorative practice for many years. And they're doing great work on that campus, moving that agenda forward. And there's, as I said, 14 other schools that have also began to learn and implement and practice restorative practices.
Well, let me ask both of you to respond to the wide range of listener feedback we're already getting. And by the way, listeners, if you want to weigh in on what you heard from Fania Davis or this kind of a conversation on restorative practices, call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. So let me read two. Jake writes to the program and says, it's obviously a bit early to tell, but with the recent comments in the Democratic election about the negatives of punitive justice and even some suggestions the war on drugs might be waning a bit, do your guests see restorative justice becoming significantly more important in the following years on a much larger scale? This stuff should be a no-brainer. It should be applied almost everywhere. That's from Jake. On the other side, Misty on Twitter says, wow, I so disagree with most of what your previous guest had to say. Seems very enabling and coddling of poor behavior. So wide range. Let me start with you, Kit. Two very, very different comments there. What do you think?
I'd like to have a conversation with Misty about how she parents. Because one of the things that for me that Fania said toward the end of the interview just now was, what do you do as a good parent? Because I like the restorative approaches because it's basically systematizing what good parents do. Good parents are interested in the moral intelligence, the moral imagination of their children. They're interested in the development of empathy. They're interested in the development of social emotional skills so that people can grow up to be good citizens. And for me, this is some of the underlying development that restorative practices offers young people and adults to be able to participate in and develop a different culture. So I think that the research results are in. If we had to start over on our justice systems in this country, I think that if looking at the research on how expensive and how wasteful and how awful the current justice system generally is versus the successes and the cost savings, the significant cost savings of restorative practices, given the fact that in this state alone, you know, it costs like $75,000 a year to incarcerate a juvenile. So if we're keeping kids out of juvenile facilities at a rate of $75,000 a kid, that's a significant savings to taxpayers. So just crunch the numbers.
Okay. Well, but let me ask Ruth on the same question then. Misty says she's concerned not too coddling, you know, and Kit just gave an explanation for why she obviously doesn't feel that way. Why do you not feel that way?
It's interesting because I hear that a lot.
Sure.
I believe it's a myth. The highest level of accountability is when you have to give an account for your actions and have to sit down and look at individuals face to face and discuss what your actions mean to that particular community. So let me just give you an example from the schools. You know, past practice would have been a student did something that deems suspension or discipline, they were given that discipline. So sometimes it's a suspension, 2 days, you're home, whatever you're doing, you come back, you pick up as if nothing happened. But to sit down in a circle and discuss how you calling a teacher, you know, cursing at a teacher or hitting another individual and what impact that's had on your community, it's a high level of accountability. So I argue that actually that is a myth because it's really the suspension or not teaching individuals how to communicate, how to problem solve, how to resolve conflicts, and how your actions have an impact on everybody. And if I have the time, I'll give you a very good example. A couple of weeks ago, I sat down with a parent and a student and some school officials discussing a situation where this student was, according to the school, was really misbehaving, really crying out for help is what I say. And when we did the circle to really dig under and let the student know that, look, all these people that your behavior, your actions has impacted. Mom spoke about missing work for 3 days, having to go back and forth and to deal with this. And then the school officials talked about the impact that it had on the teacher and her relationship with the rest of the students. And the student, after an hour of the circle, was really able to appreciate, hey, it's not just impacting me. Yes, I'm struggling with some things, but there's a better way perhaps I can do that without impacting my mother, my classmates, and my teachers in a negative way. And the understanding that our individual actions have an impact on the larger community. And I think that is the highest level of accountability.
Listeners, if the notion of restorative justice or practices is not something you've heard much about, one of the short summations I often hear is that we have an overly high level of suspension and expulsion in the Rochester City School District. We often do in urban settings. And that when you suspend and expel kids, all that does is put them on a path to having no chance to graduate. And we know, you know, what sort of outcomes tend to happen there. And so the idea is, it's not that you can't suspend or expel, but you leave that for violence, for the most part. That that you find these restorative practices more effective. And so there's two extremes here, I would say. I don't know if extreme is the right word, but on the one side, you've got zero tolerance or a possible military academy school. And then you've got restorative practices that looks at it a whole different way. And you heard Fania Davis with her concern about a military academy. She wants to see a peace academy. But you have Van White, school board president, endorsing a concept of a military academy. Ruth, I don't know, as an employee of the district, if you can weigh in on that. You may or may not. Can you talk about a military academy?
To be perfectly honest, I've not really paid it a lot of attention as I should. I know it's in the discovery stages, so
sure.
I've not attended any of the meetings, read anything on it, except what I hear in the media.
Okay. I'll let Kit then weigh in a little bit more, because Kit, on this program, Van White said he doesn't want a military style or a military academy style school for all schools. He said it would be one school, and Van's comment was, every child is different. For some children, working with them in these sort of ways that you might say are more restorative practices is more effective. But there are some kids who simply need the structure and the discipline. Maybe not all, maybe not even most, but some need that. And this would be another tool in a toolkit for the city school district. That's why he wants to see it. Do you disagree?
I think all children need structure and discipline. And that some of the kids who we are tempted to dismiss or label them with as troublesome or at risk are the ones who have a backstory, as Fania said, that most needs to be explored. I know that, one of my children had a learning disability, so it meant she was more likely to be distracted. It was harder for her to focus. She didn't get in disciplinary problems because of that, but there are many kids, who, especially with special needs, that fall into that category. I'm worried that we're basically going to put in, we're going to identify kids who we think need that, and we're not going to look at that backstory of what is it that's going on that suddenly they need to be in these highly structured environments. I just would really question, I'd like to see a lot of structure and a lot of accountability in every single school. I mean, that's what makes good humans.
So, in other words, it sounds like you think that there is this straw man argument that restorative justice is no structure, no discipline.
Absolutely. I want to support what Ruth said. I mean, it's harder. I mean, just all people have to do is look at their own life. When have you ever had to look somebody in the face and say, I screwed up and I'm sorry? Tell me what it was like for you when I did that. I'd be interested in what your listeners have to say about that, because I've been speaking about these ideas for people, for many years in the community. I've had a number of times adults, especially older adults, come up to me after they've heard me speak and say, man, I was a juvenile delinquent back in the day. I was this, I was that. And thank God somebody just pulled me aside and had a conversation with me and knocked some sense into my head. I mean, that's what restorative practices does. It doesn't send them off to, an expensive place that helps you to become a better criminal.
But specifically on a military academy school, we're starting to see a broader community conversation. And I'm sensing that you just don't think it's the right approach, even with one school kid. I mean, you don't think it has a place in the district.
I guess I need to know what it means to be in a military school. Does it mean a uniform? There's other schools in the district that have uniforms. Does it mean that they'll study military history and science?
Yes.
even more than our history is already skewed in that direction? I don't know. It's an interesting argument. I mean, one of the biggest, advocates for peace and nonviolence I'm aware of is a West Point graduate named Captain Paul Chappelle, who was here visiting in Rochester a couple of years ago. I think at West Point, they actually teach some very interesting things around strategy and thinking about safety and peace. So if it was going to be engaging people around high-level thinking, high-level sense of citizen accountability, then great. If we're prepping another pipeline for the military, I worry about that. Because I, you know, depending on who you speak to in veteran services now, we have an average of somewhere between at least 3 veterans a day committing suicide. So I don't want more of our children in this community heading into that particular pipeline.
On Twitter, Barb says, thank you, Fania Davis, for saying no to a military academy and yes to a peace school. Barb says, think of the structure and discipline that went into the nonviolence practices of Gandhi and Martin Luther King. So that's one response. But Mark says, structure and discipline sound good to me. The city has lots of problems, and I support a military academy. So again,
it's great because if everybody really wants structure and discipline, there's no one disagreeing with each other.
Okay. You agree with that, Ruth? Structure and discipline is not something we're leaving out at any school.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
And I also wanted to add on to the fact that students, restorative practice does not equate to the fact that students cannot be suspended. What we're asking is that is a last resort, realizing the impact that suspension will have on a student's life in the long term. And furthermore, we've also made a way for when our students are suspended is using restorative practices to transition them back into the school community.
We mentioned Megan Mack, our producer, in that conversation with Fania Davis. Fania touched on some of the videos that you've seen around the country, South Carolina, the school, the teacher who grabbed and physically manhandled the female student, who certainly wasn't being violent in any way. And one of our listeners wanted to know, before I get to the phones, if you're on the phone, we're coming to you in a second. Another email was asking, are these videos, is this a good thing? Are we getting more accountability because we've got you have these stories of kids, especially in urban settings, either being mistreated or going through a lot, and now the person via email is asking, is this a good thing? For example, Ruth, is it a good thing that we saw that video from South Carolina?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a good thing.
Because something he said, she said.
It happened. You know what I mean? So I think that the video gives merit to what took place and the serious problem that we have as a society, you know, this movement towards being more aggressive and violent, especially particularly you made a very good point that student at that moment was not reacting in an aggressive way or in a violent way. So it was unacceptable. And had that video not been there, I really think that would have been he said, she said, and maybe the nation would not be aware of what's taking place, what I believe, across schools, across our communities.
Okay.
I just want to put in a quick word that I think restorative practices serve teachers. You know, one of the stories that Fania told was about the teacher was able to say that she'd had this traumatic experience the year before and was scared. And adults need support, too, in the buildings. So I think restorative practices can support adults in the buildings and teachers who are often, you know, really walking around in empathy deficit mode for both structural and systemic reasons, as well as because they have really hard and stressful jobs. So I want more spaces for teachers to be heard. And I think it would be more satisfying for a teacher to be able to look at a kid and say, hey, you did this, rather than just have to take some kid back into their class 48 or 72 days hours later without a word. Think about it.
Back to the phones we go, and Peg in Rochester. Go ahead, Peg.
Yeah, hi. I'm a resident of the city, have been for a long time. My kids went to the schools, and now my grandchildren are in the schools, city schools. And I believe that this military academy is the last thing that so many of these children would need in terms of help in getting through the trauma of the poverty and racism of the city. I don't know what Dan White is referring to when he said they did a survey of residents of the city. I think it was a very limited survey, if there was one, of a select group of people. I haven't seen any surveys coming through my neighborhood. I don't know what he's referring to on that. I'd like to know what his process is in terms of thinking that people think it's a great idea. My daughter works at East High School, works very closely with the students there, and I just think that the last thing these kids need is some kind of military approach to behavior.
All right, Peg, thanks for the phone call. And you know, just another voice on the question of a military-style academy in Rochester. A retired teacher writes to us and wants to know, for Ruth Turner, who's the Executive Director of Student Support Services in Rochester, regarding the schools that do have restorative justice practices, have all the teachers bought into the program? Has it been successful so far, or is it too early to tell?
We're looking at that. What we did things a bit differently than what we've typically done in the past is that instead of this mandate that comes down from central office, we've sort of introduced school leaders and schools to the philosophy of restorative practice and gave them an invitation as to whether they felt this was something worth doing and investing in, because we realized that unless it's something that they also believed in, that it was not going to be as effective.
Sure.
So we have schools in different stages of implementation, you know, and it's too early to tell the whole picture, but we have in some schools where principals and school leaders are reporting a decrease in school violence, a decrease in suspension, overall a better sense of school climate. And then we have other schools that are not so sure yet. And there's a lot of data collection and evaluation tool that we have yet to sort of develop to capture the work, to kind of say, is this working? It's not. But the early data that we're showing is, depending at what level the school is engaged in the practice, they're more likely to be successful if they're implementing the whole sequence, the whole spectrum of restorative practices. So it's a bit early to tell, but we are engaged in evaluation, and we plan on being transparent and sharing and learning from this year what we can do better. So I'm guessing June, July, we'll have a better sense of that.
Have you had? Go ahead, Kit.
I just want to say it's exciting. I think this is about a third of the district. This is about 11,000 students we're talking about. So this is a significant opportunity.
Sure. And have you had teachers so far who have said, this is bunk, this isn't going to work? And have you had teachers who've said, I was a doubter, but I'm seeing it now?
Yep. Yeah? Both. You know, teachers have a legitimate concern. I just want to put that out on the table. You know, as an educator, the work that we do each and every day, it's difficult. It's very difficult, and oftentimes you don't get a thank you. You know, the only time your name gets called is in a negative way. So I want to really emphasize that our teachers in the city school district are working hard each and every day. And I think one of the problems that was for me when I was in the school is that where there's no time to really reflect on the work and what can we do differently. So yes, we have some teachers that are saying, I don't believe this is going to work. And we've had others who have come along and said, I don't believe in this, but have attended the training, have experienced it, and are now sort of our champions, you know? So we're going to have all that. And part of the things that we're hoping as a district, we're consistent, you know, that this is something that is going to be in the fabric of our district, and this is not going to be one of those, you know, fads that comes and goes. And I think that's important for the community to have that credibility to say, this is right for all parties, not just students. This is right for everyone. This is a very humane way of doing business and interacting with each other. This is what I want for my kids when they go to school. And this is how I would want my boss to interact with me. So we say it's for the students, but it's for the whole community.
Okay. Well, you heard Peg, listeners, say, who are these people that Van White claims are supporting a military-style school? Here's one, Perry in Rochester. Go ahead, Perry.
Yes, I just want to say that I think this is going to be a good thing, and I don't think that the speakers are giving it its fair due. Military academies have traditionally been places where you have to merit going there, and they lead on to better and bigger things, and it's just another opportunity for other academic to segue into other academics. And I don't think it's going to be the disciplinary default that it's being described as. It's not supposed to be a disciplinary default. It's supposed to be another opportunity to make something of a shambles that's happening in the city, where you're not getting the graduation rates. And it would be an honor to go, not a default to go.
All right. Perry, thanks for the phone call. Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, go ahead on that.
I don't know as much, I guess, about this as Perry does. And I still question whether or not increasing militarization is of anything, including our schools, is a good move. I just don't know. I would think not.
Okay, let me read a one more listener email. This is from Lisa. She writes, "My son was a fourth grader at a Blue Ribbon charter school in the city of Rochester and was suspended both in school and out of school several times. He's a child diagnosed with ADHD, anxiety, and two learning disabilities. When meeting with the teachers and school leaders, they dug their heels in and cited a zero-tolerance policy. The parents of the supposed victims of my son's behavior felt the reactions of the administration were unfair. When does punishment become an issue of discrimination?"
Wow, that's...
Can punishment be an issue of discrimination?
Absolutely. I definitely, the research proves in a way that it is. I think that we definitely have implicit bias. You know, those are things that we have been in a way socially conditioned in our society. So I think it absolutely could have an impact. The question becomes is how to define when it is discrimination and when it is, you know, and actual discipline. I don't know. That's a tricky thing. But we know that more often Blacks and Latino students are suspended at a higher rate than their white counterparts. So I think that we can't deny the evidence. It's there, and it's something that we as a district, you know, are aware of and are trying to find ways to train staff around that issue. And I wanted to go on record on saying this because I really try to speak my truth, is that I want to make it clear that our board, all of our board members, are in support of our restorative practice initiative. They have made it a priority to support it, have made it a priority to push for funding.
Including Van White, by the way, right?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so this isn't a case of oppositional, half the board is for this, half the board is not.
Nope, the whole board.
And as you heard Ruth mention, we're going to learn a lot more as they wrap up the school year. You get more evaluation. But Kit's right. This is not a small sample size. We're starting to see a lot more of this restorative practices movement. And Ruth, real briefly here, they want to see Fania Davis next week, 1 week from today. When?
Yes, on Wednesday, May 4th at 12:30, she'll be at REOC and also at 5:30 at RIT. There are flyers circulating. You can also call the school district at 262-8100 to get more information.
262-8100. Thank you, Ruth. Thank you for being here. Kit Miller from the Gandhi Institute, thank you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
Our thanks to Fania Davis, John Andrus, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great day.